Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost. Stand alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, from the recent GameStop-fueled market frenzy saga to one in five newbie investors giving up, mistakes happen to the best of us. But don't panic, our sage of Hertfordshire, Simon Lambert, shares some of his own bloopers and believes they make you a better investor. Meanwhile, we bring boring back to investing, and I mean that in the best possible way. We look at how to invest grandma's savings for income with minimum risk. Clue, it's not Bitcoin or GameStop. Also today, things may feel pretty negative for savers at the moment, but for now, the Bank of England has decided to stick with interest rates at 0.1%, that is. But will we soon have to start paying banks to hold our cash? Britain's booming buy now, pay later industry faces regulation, but what will that mean? And what are estate rent charges? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, we won't go over the Reddit GameStop small traders versus short sellers story in any more detail. If you want that, please listen to the last podcast. But the phenomenon that swept both sides of the pond has got our Simon thinking. Now, as major investing platforms and apps in the UK and the US reported a rush to buy, some who got in early and sold out would have made handsome profits. Others, late to the party, will have paid the price. Simon, tell us more about your thinking around your latest article and mistakes that you've made.
Well, I should start by saying that this is resolutely not another slot about GameStop. I'm sure people have read and heard plenty about GameStop over the past week. We did a whole podcast on it last week, which brought a reasonable amount of criticism for some of the things we said. However, suffice it to say that the price of GameStop that had been pushed up by the Reddit-fueled trading frenzy to more than $400 a week ago is now at $53. So if you bought in anywhere near that peak last week and in the frenzy, then you are likely to have lost money. You might have made money, you might have sold out at a higher price, but there was a lot of talk of holding the line, diamond hands, all that kind of stuff. And anybody who did get involved near the end and did so in order to make a quick buck, and there will be plenty of people who did that, where the line lies on fighting the system of making a quick buck is highly debatable. But there will be plenty of people who thought they'd make a quick buck and plenty of people who possibly shoved in more money than they should have done, because that's always the temptation to make a quick buck. And some of them will be sitting on sizable paper losses and wondering if the price is ever going to go anywhere near back up to where it was, which, to be honest, seeing as it wasn't based on really any form of fundamental value of the company, but more to do with the trading surge, looks pretty unlikely. But this is actually about investing mistakes, because if you are sitting there looking at the GameStop thing and thinking, I made a mistake there, or if you're thinking other people made a mistake there, it's to say that really in investing and trading, there's nothing wrong with making a mistake. We all make them and we just need to learn about them. And so this week I wrote a column about making investing mistakes and learning from them, specifically mine. And I thought it would be timely to write this, but also because we've discussed it a few times recently and before the GameStop stuff in our meetings. And Tanya Jeffries, who's our pension and investing editor, has long said that one of the problems she has with share tipping columns or investing columns or anything like that, recommendations, they always talk about the stuff that you should buy and what they think looks good and what they think will do well. And then the successes can often be revisited. And yes, we said to buy this, or yes, we recommended that, and yes, this was great. But the ones that weren't a success are allowed to quietly drift into the background. And there will be many, many share tips, recommendations, buys, decisions, bandwagons that people jump on, investing trends, whatever you want to call them, that won't turn out to have been that great. But a loss, a bad decision, a failure to act, any other form of mistake can be learned from. It can be chalked up as the cost of your investing education, I guess. Now, that's obviously something that's easier to do if you haven't lost a large and extremely meaningful sum of money. And if you have done that, and I mentioned this in my column as well, and you are struggling to cope, then speak to someone, whether that's a member of family, a friend that you trust, a professional, someone entirely neutral, because a problem like that shared becomes much easier to deal with, and that can really, really upset people, and people can really struggle with that kind of stuff. But if we're just talking about the kind of investing loss that might be painful, but is easier to bear, and you can go, I wish I hadn't done that. I've probably lost more than I could afford to lose, or I've lost something I could afford to lose, but it still hurts me. What can you learn from them? Well, do you want me to give a few examples of mine over the years?
Of course, I want some examples.
So, the first one, and one I always hark back to, is HMV shares. Now, this, I think, was probably my first sort of real adventure into direct investing on my own account. And HMV at the time, this was 2010, was the last man standing selling music on the high street. All of the other main music sellers had vanished, and you were left with HMV, and then you could go into the big supermarkets. But, you know, that's not really music shopping. That's just whatever's they're flogging that's in the charts. HMV is a proper music shop. You went in there, you got a proper selection of music, CDs, vinyl. And my theory was that people, although everybody was getting into downloads, Amazon was rampant, people would always want to go browse for and buy music. And it owned Waterstones at the time. My theory was they would always want to do the same with books. The shares were also cheap. The share price had come down a lot. And there was a 10% dividend yield on it. Okay, that's massive. Even back then, that was massive. And I thought, bargain. This is their market's overlooking this one. And in a sense, I was right, because people did still want to browse and buy physical music and books. It just was HMV that was wrong. It managed to completely stuff it up. It failed to capitalize on that unique position it had. It came up with a strategy that, amongst other things, involved a focus on selling more t-shirts. It made a daft move into buying a load of music venues. It was laden down with debt, I seem to remember, and always look at the debt. The debt is a massive issue for companies. The dividend, that 10% dividend yield, it was a trap. It was a dividend trap. It was unsurprisingly cut. The shares actually briefly made me some money. They did go up for a bit. And this is the most painful thing with any form of investing mistake is when you were actually at one point up and then you end up a lot down. Ultimately, I sold out at a 60% loss. The lessons that I learned there: don't overestimate a company based on what you think should happen. Instead, look at what it's actually doing. Because I think if I'd have dug properly into what HMV was saying at the time, the warning signs, the red flags, that what I thought HMV should do was not what it was doing, would have been there and I would have been able to see them. Beware dividend traps. If a share is yielding 10%, there may be a very good reason for that. And its ability to continue paying that dividend relies on dividend cover and, you know, cash flow, various other things. And if it just looks like it's not going to be able to keep it up, it just won't keep it up. And also have a portfolio of more than one stock. I basically just held HMV. And that's actually slight artistic license. I also held some Tesco shares. But yeah, two isn't enough either. I was naive with HMV. A year and a bit later, I dipped some more toes in. It hadn't put me off dipping my toes in, but I bought into a smaller company's gold fund. Now, this is 2011, kind of summer of 2011. The gold price was soaring. If you hadn't bought gold, you were kicking yourself, because the gold bugs had been telling you to buy gold, buy gold, buy gold. And whenever you're watching the price of something go up, especially if it's something you thought about buying, it's always slightly painful. But there was an idea being sort of knocked around, and that was that there was a way to play this that still offered an opportunity. The gold price had gone up a lot, but gold miners' shares hadn't. There was a gap between them, and there was a theory that with gold, even if gold was above a certain price, then the gold miners just couldn't fail to make much bigger profits. And when people realized this, their share prices would rise, the gap would close. I listened to this, I heard people talk about it, I thought, yeah, that's it, this is a surefire winner. And I invested more than I should have done. I invested £2,000 into a smaller company's gold fund in September 2011. The £2,000 was a sizable sum of money for me back then. It's a sizable sum of money anyway, but it was a big chunk of my savings. I think that potentially maybe the gap did narrow slightly, but that was only because the price of gold started falling. And then the gap widened again, as barring a sort of like brief respite in the gold price, it then continued to slide. And unsurprisingly, risky small gold miners slid even harder. The fund that I had invested in was an absolute dog anyway, and I had not also backed it at the worst possible time. Every time I opened my investment account, I would have this fund staring at me with a sort of, you know, first it was 20% down, then it was 30%, then it was 40%. Anything staring at you with more than a 40% loss is painful. And I held on to it for much longer than I should have done. I eventually sold in April 2013 with £662 less left. That was a 67% loss. The lesson there, don't be too greedy with a supposed surefire winner, because that's how you get sucked in. You think, this can't possibly fail. Instead of putting £500 in or £1,000 in, I'll put £2,000 or £5,000. You know, it's very tempting when you think there's some easy money on the table to go, I could make a killing here. Don't do that. Also, once you know you've made a bad decision, consider cutting your losses. If you've just invested in something that you still think the investment case stands up, then you should stick by it. But if you realize that you're a mug and you've mugged yourself off, then it might be time to cut those losses, because whilst that money was sitting there just doing nothing and slowly dwindling away, I was missing out on lots of other opportunities I could have put it to work in. Some other lessons have involved buying like story stocks, story companies, a company called Quindel, very controversial AIM kind of insurance star, was making like incredible profits. And then it had to restate its figures and became the subject of a fraud probe. It was later dropped, but very, very controversial. Unsurprisingly, lost money on the Quindel stake. Cam Kids, this was from a bargain shares portfolio that I read about from a guy who's a good analyst in another publication. Looked extremely cheap. Price to earnings ratio was minute. And so I thought, wow, great. So I put some money into that. Turned out to be cheap for a reason. It was extremely iffy. It delisted from AIM. It was a Chinese children's clothing company, and it wasn't even possible to verify whether it actually was a Chinese children's clothing company. Like, you couldn't, I mean, the UK, you know, it didn't sell clothes in the UK. Apparently it sold clothes in China, and apparently it made these profits and its shares were really, really lowly valued, but I can't go to China and check whether these clothes exist. I did actually have a quick look on the internet when it turned out to look really iffy. Couldn't verify it. So yeah, I mean, Dumbo in that case. Anyway, luckily by this point, I'd learned that there's a portfolio approach to share picking. Don't have just one or two. So that was part of maybe I've built up this portfolio of 15 shares. So I lost money on those two. It wasn't a big sum of money, but still I was kicked myself afterwards. I was like, I mean, both of these things just looked too good to be true. And oh yeah, they were too good to be true. So over the years, my portfolio has grown. I've invested more, you know, I've earned more and invested more and things like that. I've mainly abandoned individual share picking. I still do a little bit with one of the free trading apps just for fun kind of thing. Yeah. And I've switched largely to investment trusts and funds. I'm happy to pay a professional to do the work for me. Do keep an eye on those professionals. One of those professionals, see podcast past, was a certain Mr. Neil Woodford. Lesson here, pay attention to what people are doing. I mean, he published a full list of all of his holdings, and ditch fund managers who drift off piste. And, you know, if the fund manager has been really good at one thing, maybe they're not going to be really good at another thing, investing in small risky biotech companies and strange things going on with where they're being listed in Guernsey and stuff like that. But then I've now reached the point where I've got the portfolio I've got now, but I look at that and there's mistakes in there. I've cut out a lot of the dross, right? A lot of those, you know, there's not stuff in there. I don't look at it and think, what was I thinking? With much stuff in there anymore. Maybe the odd thing where I'm like, that was stupid. But there's too much stuff in there. Yeah. So most of the ISA, most of it is in my investment ISA. Now, most of that is in 25 investment trusts, funds, and shares, right? So a holding of 25 different things. And if you go down to the smallest one of those holdings, it represents about 1.5% of the portfolio. But there's also this long tail of another 30 or so different investments are made up of a ragtag bunch of things that I've bought over the years. And some of them are like 0.1%, 0.3% of the portfolio. Realistically, as an individual investor, that there's no real point, I don't think, in holding that many things. My personal view is you hold the number of things that you can keep track of and pay attention to. there's a thing that gets referred to as diversification, where basically you diversify beyond the point where you're getting the benefit of diversifying and you start diversifying away your returns. I would really like to tidy it up, shift the focus to like maybe 10 or 15 main investments, sit there and go through them like line by line. What's this? Is it worth me having? Should I sell it? Should I put the money into the stuff that I've got real conviction in? The problem is the cost of doing so would be really expensive. I've got an interactive investor account. It would cost me £7.99, right, to buy or sell. So that's £8 a throw, right? To sell 40 different holdings, and then it'd be the same cost again to buy into more of the remaining 15, I'd be looking at about £440 in dealing fees. And that's just something that you just like, I'm not paying them that much in dealing fees. So I just leave it there, that long tail, and I try to ignore from it. But I'm pretty sure, as I said, I'm over-diversifying. And I think the lesson there is that while you shouldn't put all of your eggs into one basket, you can also have too many baskets. So right. that's my list of investing mistakes that I wrote about. I can guarantee you that if you wanted to just listen to me witter on for another hour or so, I could tell you about plenty more. But that ultimately, that's the thing, is sit down, think about them, and learn from them. That's the point. And it's not actually until you sit down and you write them down and you really think about them properly. The HMV one, the smaller companies gold mining one, I've spoken about this before. I did it in a talk I did once at an investing show. I talked about those things and I thought about the mistakes of those. Some of the others, I haven't really thought about the mistakes of them. So obviously I'm not expecting all of our listeners to sit and write a column about their investing mistakes, but sit down, write them on a piece of paper, think, what did I do wrong there? What did I do right? And learn from that stuff and chalk it up to the cost of investing education, as I said.
Well, we're going to talk about why people quit investing. And one of them, I imagine, is having made a mistake, burnt, and then they're out of there. But would love to know as well, has anybody got any mistakes that they want to share with us? As Simon said at the start, problem shared, problem halved and all that. And we can learn from them as well. Lee, I'm wondering if... I know this is certainly probably the case with me. It's not necessarily the mistakes I make, but the biggest of all those mistakes is admitting to myself that I've made a mistake. You know, when you know you've mugged yourself off, but you keep thinking, oh, yeah, but this will come good. This will come good. I know this will come good because I've done my research, et cetera, et cetera. Is there an element of that? Have you ever made any mistakes, Lee?
I definitely think there's an element of that, Georgie. I think sometimes you've got to realise, as Simon was saying there, giving the example of HMVs, that it's always quite disheartening selling something at a loss, no matter what it is. And it's just a case of letting it go and realising that you need to exit to move forward and, you know, perhaps potentially become a better investor from the back of that. In terms of investing mistakes for myself, Georgie, I'm a novice of a novice investor. It's only been the last few years, really, that I've had enough disposable income to start getting involved in investing, starting a young family, buying a home, student loans, all sorts of things had to take precedence before that. But in the last couple of years, I have started dipping my toes into the world of investing. The one thing I would say, and I think this is a common mistake, especially for people who are first starting out in their potentially early 30s and 20s, is that we're now blessed with so much information at our fingertips, as in we've got loads of apps and different ways in which we can get involved in investing with quite small nominal amounts, which in a way is, you know, great. It's great that all these options are out there and innovation is out there, but it's not a mistake so much, but it's just a tip. I definitely, the first year of investing, was constantly looking at how the performance was. And there's absolutely no point of doing that if you're investing, because out of a few investing pots that I have, I've got various goals for them, and all of the goals are longer than 10 years. So what does it matter what it's doing in year one? I mean, if it's lost 10%, what am I going to do in year one? Go, oh no, this was a mistake, and take it out. I think there's quite a lot of element of that. People going, oh, hold on, I thought investing meant I was going to make way more money than, you know, just putting it in a savings account. But you should be looking, of course, at the long term, as Simon always hammers home on this podcast. Against that rule is individual share picking, you know, picking companies and knowing when to exit. You know, that's a kind of different ball game. But in other ways of investing, if you know that you've got a pot and you want it to grow over a certain amount of years, don't just keep refreshing it every day, looking at it, oh, it's gone down 2%, oh, it's up 3%, all of that kind of thing. I think you've just got to, depending on how you're investing, if you've invested a lump sum, and just leaving it there, or if you're drip feeding money into it, it's just to try and ignore it. That's, you know, not a mistake. It was a mistake I did in year one. I would say now I'm sort of more like year three, year four. I've just completely forgotten about it. I've very, very rarely looked at it.
Which in itself can be a mistake, though. I mean, I was exactly the same.
It's about the balance.
I became quite obsessional, but then as a result of that, I became interested in it. And therefore, you want to learn a little bit more. So it really depends. Not necessarily a mistake to keep looking at it. It depends how you act on that.
No knee-jerk reactions is what I would probably say. But again, it depends on what you're invested in and how you're invested. But I definitely feel better from not keep looking at it and looking at it just occasionally.
The good thing, though, with Lee as a novice investor is you've stuck at it. You've got your goals. You've got your long-term goals. But just reading some research that you got in This Is Money from broker Charles Stanley Direct, saying that 1 in 5 newbie investors who try quit altogether, citing things like mistakes, obviously, losses, volatile markets, jargon, too much research. Lee, tell us more about what they found and the significance of that. Because that to me is quite a surprising figure. That these people are savvy enough to go for it and then quit.
I think it would be interesting to know kind of if the research went a bit deeper about after how long. Do you know what I mean? If it's like within a year, then it's kind of like, wow, okay, that's probably not, you know, not great. But if it's after doing it for 5 or 10 years or whatever, it's a kind of different bit of research. But I think, you know, as an overview, I think it's, if you are someone that has invested and is tempted to leave because of all those things, I mean, really, you should have researched before getting involved. You know, markets, of course, they go up and down. You know, and I think it's important to sort of set goals in the future as to what it is that you want from your investment account. I think a lot of people at the moment are just in danger of going, well, savings rates are rubbish, so I'm just going to get involved in investing without fully kind of understanding it. But on the flip side of that, you can end up talking yourself out of getting involved because there is volatility. There is, you know, the scope to lose money, especially 1 year you might be down a bit, the next year you might be up a bit. And I think it's an interesting piece of research because I think there's been a bit of a shift. There's definitely been a bit of a culture shift in the last sort of few years with sort of apps and ways of getting involved in investing that I mentioned. A decade ago, it was quite hard to start investing with, you know, perhaps £50 a month or something along those lines. You know, there's a lot of fees that eat into things and the sign is the dealing fees and all that kind of thing. It's become a bit easier to sort of like round up your spending, for example, and put it into a pot that's then invested in something and all that kind of like almost like gamification of investing and our finances. So in one way, that's all been good. But in other ways, I think people see these cuddly, cozy looking apps and don't realize that they're going to lose money. They could lose money, you know, and that's the nature of investing. There was also this bit in this research that highlighted quite a big gender gap. So 31% of women choose not to invest because they have no idea to begin, which compares to 20% of men, which usually I'm not all that interested in gender divides and stuff, but I think that is quite a sizable gap. And the other thing is people were talking about in the research jargon. So they don't like jargon. And two in five people said, you know, simplifying jargon would help. And then I looked at the list of jargon and the jargon list, you know, from a basic investor level, you should be able to read what this jargon is within sort of half an hour to an hour and kind of get to grips with what it is. And some of the jargon that people cited in the research were terms like shares, bonds, funds, the stock market, ISAs, and diversification. Now, you won't be going, oh, that all sounds a bit simple. But remember, we're in the industry, you know, we are financial journalists. That's the thing.
We are. Lee, but the point I made before was these are people who are, I see savvy enough, as I said, to get involved investing in the first place. So it'd be nice to know what sort of investing they're getting involved in and why. I mean, perhaps these are a fifth of people who got involved in Bitcoin just because the hairdresser or the taxi driver said it. I mean, it would be nice to know why they got involved, because to get involved in investing, you assume a certain level of financial understanding, maybe.
So one of the problems here relates to loss aversion. There's something called prospect theory, okay, which was developed by Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky, right? Famous US psychologists. And they did a lot of research into this. And basically, it looked at how individuals assess their losses and gains. And it's asymmetric. So you are much more averse to losses than you take pleasure in gains. So for example, the pain from losing $1,000 could only be compensated by the pleasure of earning $2,000. So I think that there is a thing where people make a loss. They don't like seeing that loss. They think that it means that they're stupid. They've done the wrong thing. They should never have done this in the first place. Investing is for other people, the other people who they read about making gains, the other people who they hear about making gains. They shouldn't have done it. Now's not the right time. Maybe they need to wait till they've got more money. All that kind of stuff. Okay, so there's that mind talk that goes on. But it is a long-term gain. And in any given year, you could be down. The longer you go out over those years, the more likely you are to be up. Some really good figures in the Barclays Equity Gilt study that show how, in, you know, once you start going up in years, the chances of you making a loss over that period of time comes down dramatically. And also you then start making a real return, a real return that's considerably better than a savings account. And if you average a real return of 4% a year, right, that sounds not great, or even 3% a year, but that's 3% above inflation. Bear in mind, you're going to struggle to find a savings account that beats inflation that you can take your money out of when you want it anyway. You're going to have to go for a fixed rate, and even those don't beat inflation by that much. But there's also another place where loss aversion comes into it. And I think this is a mistake that people make, which is a failure to act. Okay, so people will pay money into an investment account. Once they get over that hurdle, they'll pay their money in, and then they've got to invest it into something. And then they worry about picking the wrong thing. It's not necessarily about choosing the absolute best investment that they're concerned about. They're concerned about picking the wrong one, the one that will lose the money. There's the loss aversion thing going on there. And that feeds into a lack of activity. It feeds into people pulling out, I think, of investing, but it also feeds into a lack of activity. And sometimes the best thing that you can do is to act, is to make a decision and go for it and do something. And I will give you a personal example of this. Last May, my wife paid a lump sum into her pension because she's self-employed. Business was not good. She wasn't really working at the time. It obviously was, you know, lockdown, homeschooling, all that kind of stuff. And she asked me about what she should do about her pension payments because she pays a certain amount in. I said, why don't you just pay in a lump sum and then it's done. It cover you for the next, you know, 10 months of what you'd have paid into a pension if you've got that money in savings. So she decided to do that. And then she said, oh, I need to invest it into something. So she just paid it into the pension. I was like, yeah, I'll help you. And we just never got around to doing it. We never got around to acting. Every so often she'd say, I was like, yeah, I'll help you. And then there's always something else going on. The other day, we had dinner. She's like, I really need to do that with the money that's gone into my pension. I was like, yeah. I was like, let's do it after dinner. Let's do it after we put the kids to bed. She's like, no, let's just do it straight after dinner before we put the kids to bed. And then it's done. We open the investment account. She's already got stuff that she's invested in her pension. We just invested the money and shared it around a few of those funds. It literally took us 10 minutes. And we failed to act on that for 7 months. And the market's gone up quite a bit since then. It was actually kind of trading near a low. Similar conversation I was having with my wife's sister the other day. We were talking about it. Same thing. She'd meant to pay some money in last April, decided she was going to do it in chunks, and then did one chunk and then didn't do the other chunks, kind of thing. And it can be a lack of activity that holds you back. And a lack of activity at a time when you're really tempted not to act, because put it this way, last April and May did not feel like a great time to be putting money into the stock market. But actually, it was a great time to be putting money into the stock market. I myself have repeatedly said over the years that if the stock market fell 30% again, I would invest all of my spare cash, because you know that's the big drop. That's one of the big ones. And it did fall 30%. And I didn't do that last March or last April. But what if it continues to go down? And it could have continued to go down. Very well could have done. Loss aversion going on there. But it didn't. It bounced back up. Now, who's to say it's not going to fall again? But I'm not investing for the next year. I'm not investing for the next 2 years. I'm not even investing for the next 5 years. I'm investing over decades. And, you know, so I can afford to ride it out. If you would really affect you, if you need that money in a year's time, then loss aversion is a very good thing to be having. But there is that mistake that comes in, I think, where people fail to act, or because they are loss averse, they take the losses too hard and forget that they should be thinking over a really long time period. And like, to go back to why did I write that column? Why did we write this thing? Why did Tony talk about it? It's because I think that actually, in terms of trying to demystify investing for people and help people with getting their head around it, maybe sometimes the most important thing that people can do is actually tell other people about their mistakes and what they did and what they learned, and be kind of honest about it. Because I think that we just hear like too much of the success story, and then we do something and we don't become an immediate success, and we think, well, I'm just rubbish at it, it's not for me, I'm too stupid for this, I can't do this. And that's not true.
No, I'd love to read about why tips didn't do as well as people thought. I'd love to read people's experts' opinion on that. But okay, after recent excitement, we're going to stick with investing, but we're going to move on because it's been a bit rock and roll recently, I think. So we're going to bring it down a little bit. We're going to talk classical. You have a reader question. It's about a granny who has £100,000 in savings, but she's, like most of us, pretty fed up with savings rates at the moment, and she wants her money to work harder, although she doesn't want to go nuts. She wants to have a nice growth income and use it to supplement her state pension. She doesn't have a pension, I understand. She does have some other cash savings. It's not like she's going to put all her money into this. Lee, tell us a bit more and what the advice was.
Well, not that long ago, Georgie, there's been a lot of people that would be in this boat. So basically, they have their state pension. They have some a nice chunk of savings that they've saved up, and they could easily get a couple of percent on the high street, regular income bonds, a nice little monthly payout that helps top up their state pension and keep them ticking over, and everything's hunky-dory. However, the last few years have seen a real dwindle of the rates that are offered on from banks and building societies, including things like income bonds, make it very difficult to get that monthly return, which is popular with the older generation. So we've had this question come in, £100,000, what to do with it? Don't want to really risk the cash, but that's the trade-off, because if you want 2-4% returns, there is an element of risk involved at the moment, most definitely, because you're going to probably need to get involved in investing. Now, the first thing to say about anyone that finds himself in a situation like this, first port of call might be an independent financial advisor for you, because, you know, unless you're confident doing lots of research yourself and looking at how to do this, even though there's more research out there and easier ways to do this than ever before, some people just will not feel confident to put six figures somewhere, and I can totally understand why. But you have to remember, if you do get some professional advice, that's going to cost money, and that's going to eat into your pot of cash and your potential return. But it might be worth it, and it's definitely an avenue worth exploring, and there's lots of good IFAs out there. So if you are tempted by that, just make sure you do research as to who it is that you're going to be talking to and how much they're going to charge and all of that kind of thing. So we asked three experts what potentially they could do about this. Now, one of the things about this question is I'm not fully sure how old this person is, which actually does change the context a little bit, because as we were saying earlier, when it comes to investing, it's all about the timeline, and whether you're going to be investing for 20 years or 10 or 20 years, for example, is quite a big difference as to what your approach might be. There's lots of funds and things out there that do this kind of sliding approach with caution to risk. So you might go for something that's, you know, quite often there's like a scale of like 1 to 7, 7 being the most extreme risk, 1 being the least extreme. So you might plump for an option like that, a pre-packaged portfolio of funds and things that will basically be right low on the risk factor, but the potential is that the returns will be far lower than the riskier ones. But of course, if there is a year of negative growth, it's more likely to be way less extreme than if you were in the riskier version. So in this first one, a senior client advisor at NetWealth, saying that, you know, about this exposure to stock market, it's all about having a balanced portfolio and aiming for about 3.3% return, which would give a nice sort of couple hundred pounds payout per month. But as they say in this, she has to consider that to do this, there is a potential for, you know, the pot to fall in value in 1 year, and then, you know, over long term there'll be more positive returns. They don't actually name a specific way of doing this, but just basically that's what you should be targeting in terms of a return. Now, lots of ways of investing. You can look at past performance, which is of course no indicator of what's going to happen in the future, but it might give you a good gauge of what you might be looking to potentially return. We spoke to Jason Hollins at Best Invest. He was saying again, about how savings rates have just completely fallen, and even things like UK gilts are just, you know, just the rates are just so low. There is some sort of tips in here, and he recommends this 91 diversified income fund. It has a 17% exposure to equities, shares basically, which is the most volatile asset class. So again, it's a kind of way of getting into investing, but potentially with less risk than going all guns blazing with something that's completely out there and exposed loads to shares and, you know, potential stock market knocks. And then we also spoke to Adrian Locock from Willis Owen. He suggests a portfolio of between 10 and 20 funds. And in this story, you can have a look at what he kind of recommends. I won't go through them all. He says, having 70% in bonds is suitable for a cautious investor. And I would suggest the Janus Henderson strategic bond, which yields around 3%. So if you're interested in that, potentially go and have a look along at that. And then lastly, we were talking here about Vanguard. Now, Vanguard is a popular provider. It's really sort of snowballed in popularity, I would suggest, in the last 5 to 10 years. And it has its life strategy funds, which we've spoken about on here quite a bit because of the low cost element of them and how much the fees are. I mean, it's incredibly low. I think it's 0.22%, which is, you know, quite a lot under industry standards. Now, these life strategy funds, they have a life strategy 20, 40, 60, 80, and 100. Now, the 100% is the most risky one, and the 20% is the least risky, but it's 20% in equity and 80% in bonds. And having a look at how it's done in previous years, it returned 7.5% last year, 9.9% in 2019. It lost 1.1% in 2018 and returned 10.4% in 2016 and 4.4% in 2016. So, and the previous figure was for 2017. So out of those 5 years, there was 1 year of loss, which if that was year one, people, you know, who might be investing might fall into that Charles Stanley direct research and go, oh, it's dropped this year. Is this going to be a continuous theme? But it just gives a kind of indication of how you can get involved in investing with as minimal risk as possible, but there is still a risk involved. You know, it's not the same as putting £100,000 in a bank and building society with a guaranteed rate of interest every year. And that is the trade-off. And that is, I reckon this is a very, very common question at the moment. I think given the amount of traffic and the amount of people that read that story, there's a lot of people in a similar boat, either themselves or an elderly relative who has managed to build up a nice pot of cash, perhaps doesn't have a private pension, has no idea now how to return a monthly income from it.
Yeah, well, you can understand it. We're reading so much, especially this week, that potentially rates could go negative. I mean, we had the Bank of England that kept them at 0.1%, but put the banks on notice while they were stressing that this is not definitely going to happen. It, you know, it's got people asking the question, are we going to have to start paying banks to hold our cash? On the reverse of that, a homeowner's going to be paid to have a mortgage, maybe? Look, Simon, explain to us what's going on here.
Negative rates, the ultimate interest rate weapon, or pointless, depending upon your point of view. Does the Bank of England cut the base rate from its current lowly 0.1% and take it into negative territory? What would be the point of this? Well, the point of this would be that it would effectively cost the banks money to leave cash sat with the Bank of England, which would therefore encourage them to do stuff with that cash instead, i.e. expand their lending. And the way to expand your lending is to increase the you know, the potential supply of it and raise the demand of it. How do you raise the demand of it? Well, you could make the cost of borrowing cheaper and then more people would want to borrow. But is there any point, going back to the other bit, are people not borrowing because, like, money's too expensive to borrow? Or are people not borrowing because they're a bit worried about stuff at the moment? I don't know. I don't think people aren't borrowing because money's too expensive to borrow. Money's pretty cheap at the moment. People aren't borrowing because they're worried about stuff, whether that's businesses worried about expanding, coronavirus, lockdowns, blah, blah, blah. I don't need to explain more about that. Consumers, well, they've been saving money and paying down their debt. One of the few benefits of lockdown is that people have saved a load of money because they've not spent it due to limited opportunity to spend it. And they've actually used some of that money to build up better savings balances than they had before and pay off the credit card and loan debt. Savers, they'd be the people who'd be hit by this the hardest. They've got money in savings accounts already earning a pitiful amount of interest, in many cases below the inflation rate. Would banks take the rates on savings accounts negative so that you were effectively charging the bank to hold your money? Sorry, so that the bank was effectively charging you for it to hold your money? I'm not so sure. I think you just see more being cut to 0%, which, to be honest, with some at 0.01%, they might as well be 0% anyway. Maybe they might charge people, but there'll always be some who'll pay people a positive rate. And there's no suggestion that the Bank of England is going to ban paying interest on savings. It's all the kind of knock-on effect of monetary policy. But once you start to get down to this lower bound, the effects of monetary policy become limited and potentially skewed and biased. And it might just be enough to have the threat of negative rates rather than actually negative rates. The threat has stepped up. The Bank of England has put banks on notice to be able to deal with them, because there's a worry that actually banks' systems aren't set up to deal with negative rates. They're only set up to deal with rates that are positive. Sounds silly, but you need to remember how old some of the architecture that some bank systems are based on is. And it might be that it's just the threat, the old Maradona swerve, the threat of Maradona ducking and diving down the pitch, dribbling the ball, was enough that he could instead just run straight down the pitch in a straight line and smash the ball into the back of the net. Andrew Bailey's not quite Maradona. Even Mark Carney wasn't quite Maradona. I think in their minds, they're the monetary Maradona. Who knows? I still don't think we're going to see negative rates in this country. I still don't think we're going to see negative rates in this country. I would put money on that, just not too much money.
Do you not get a sense, though, that even if we don't go negative, that banks might use this as another opportunity to lower some savings rates, to perhaps have more paid for bank accounts, those sorts of things? Do you think this will pave the way for that?
Sorry, monetary Maradona has really got me. That's one of the best descriptions I've heard in financial journalism for a long time. That is brilliant. Look, Georgie, I don't think that really savings rates could head much lower from the major high street banks, really. Most of them offer 0.01% on easy access accounts, and most of them don't offer much in the way of fixed bonds. And yes, there is an occasional battle for current account customers with things like banking bribes, but that's only so they can potentially get you in as a current account customer to cross-sell you other things like credit cards and loans and mortgages that make them money. I thought if savings rates went negative, as Simon says, there will always be other providers that will offer rates that will be positive, maybe not, you know, incredibly high, and maybe we're only talking somewhere between like 0.1 and 0.5%. But I think if you start charging negative rates, if you have a savings account at 0.01% and people are just basically lazy and don't want to move that money because they don't want to go and chase 0.5% somewhere, that's one thing. If you start charging people 0.01% minus, which is only a 0.02 percentage point difference, you will start to see people go, well, hold on a minute, this is starting to cost me money. This isn't right. I'm moving. Now, the only thing that might be different towards that is that the fear would be from the banks that people would just simply withdraw any kind of savings and money that they've got and just stick it under the mattress, which I think, to be honest with you, I think mattress sales have probably sort of boomed in recent years because people probably are doing that a little bit more than previously. And then let's not forget, in the last year, a lot of people have become almost like accidental savers, as in people have been tucking away money if they're lucky enough to have stayed in their job and perhaps cut down not having to commute, not going on holiday, all that kind of thing. We've talked about this a few times. You know, they've built up that pot of cash and they're trying to do with it what they can. If you start going into negative, I think that people would take the money out, but they might. The only thing I would say is that there are some people who are fortunate enough to have big savings buffers and potentially play the FSCS game, as in they spread money around to have that £85,000 protection. You know, I'm talking about wealthy individuals here, people that have cash spread around all sorts of places. They are the people that would probably be most likely hit, because you can't withdraw £85,000 over a bank counter and stick it under your mattress unless you're incredibly brave. So that's who might get hit. but I can't, Georgie, I just can't see it happening. I feel like we have spoken about negative rates for a very, very, very long time. Come on, bring it on. Let's see what happens. Let's put it into practice. Let's see what goes on. Let's see what happens if it actually happens, and we can just stop spitballing about what might happen if it happens.
Look, one thing the Bank of England did also update us on was the economy. There was some interesting stuff there. In its last November inflation and interest rates report, it suggested that it thought we were going to avoid a double dip recession, because whilst we were going to see negative growth in the last 3 months of 2020, we would see positive growth in the first 3 months of 2021. That has actually now flipped around. It expects GDP to drop by around 4% in the first quarter of this year. So January through to March looks pretty likely. We're in lockdown and we ain't coming out of it before at least the middle of March, I wouldn't think. But interestingly, it says, and we won't know this for certain until the middle of this month when the figures are out, it says it thinks that maybe GDP might actually not have fallen in the last quarter of last year, that it might actually have risen slightly. So if it did rise slightly in the last quarter of last year, as you need two successive quarters of negative growth to get a recession, we would avoid recession even if it did fall in this quarter. As to what happens after this quarter or after...
Well, yes.
After the end of this month or after the end of this podcast, like, heaven knows. So making predictions on that kind of stuff is slightly tricky at the moment. But yeah, it was a upbeat for the year ahead outlook, but just downbeat for the months that we're actually in right now.
Well, I was going to say that in terms of it going negative in terms of rates, they did say highly unlikely because they expect inflation to rise closer to the 2%. We've got successful vaccine rollout, et cetera, but this is so contingent, like you say, on the measures that come next. Who can know? Nobody could have predicted what would have happened over the last year. But anyway, we're going to put all this to one side because I want to revisit something we've spoken about in the past. I know, as exercises all a little bit, and this is the buy now, pay later industry. Regulars to the show will have heard some of our concerns and views about it. I mean, services like Clearpay, Klarna and Laybuy, which provide short-term interest-free financing to consumers. You will have seen it pop up much more. I've certainly noticed it much more whenever I'm buying. And established brands as well. And it seems that we're not the only ones who are a little bit concerned by this. It's a £2.7 billion growing industry. And it will soon come under the regulation of the Financial Ombudsman Service. But what will that mean, Lee? Just recap, actually, in 60 seconds, this industry, what are our concerns?
Yeah, so this industry has really sort of boomed in recent years, Georgie. I mean, it's kind of been around since the mid-2010s, but it's really taken off in the last year or two. And we've seen way more people that are buying in this way, and it tends to be the under 35. So I think there's something like 75% of all the customers are under that age. Now, what it means, what it is basically when you go to buy an item, you can choose to slice it. So basically, you can £100 product, for example, and you could pay that over three installments, over 3 months, £33 a go. And that is the kind of the USP for it. And it's very in simple terms. People can load up a basket of goods, go to pay it, choose that method, might not have a credit check, might have a very soft credit check, and boom, away you go, done. Now, I, as a journalist, take a very neutral view of all things. I like to look at things from all angles, and I'm not just going to pile on and say, this is an absolutely awful industry, it's about time, blah, 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 blah. Yes, regulation was needed for this industry. It has grown out of nowhere very quickly, and I do not want to see consumers get burnt, as in people getting into debt, buying things they unnecessarily need, and get treated badly by companies that are offering this. And the other thing that buy now, pay later encourages is more spend. So people choose to spend more. I mean, there's been studies done that suggest this is anywhere between 30 to 60% because people can spread the cost and think, well, hold on a minute, I can load up more because I can afford it over 3 months. But you can fall into a bit of a spiral of doing that, because you're just kicking the can down the road and then getting more stuff and kicking the can down the road. And something like 90% of all of it is used for things like fashion. And I think fashion and beauty are like the two big things, which, you know, highlights a bit of a problem, because it's unlikely that people that are loading up baskets this way and spending a lot of money need all of the clothes that they're buying. in these baskets. But in some ways, I actually think that the buy now, pay later industry does have a place and does have a use. For example, do you remember Brighthouse? You know, that went that went under, and that was one of those companies where you get a washing machine, say, for £400, and then you'd be charged absolute sky-high interest on it. And by the time you paid back whatever it was you paid back, you probably would have paid more than £1,000 back. I mean, that is an example of a company that is, was ripping off people, in my opinion. You know, it was absolutely a plague of the high street. You know, it was not a good thing for people to get into those kind of debt traps. However, with buy now, pay later, let's say in the same scenario, you need to get a new washing machine and you can split that over 3 monthly payments, potentially 6 monthly payments with a soft credit check with 0% interest. Well, hold on a minute. For some people, that's not a bad place to be, or a way of financing something. And actually, in the beginning of things like credit cards, I mean, credit cards were seen as an absolutely evil thing. Now we just see a credit card as a bit of plastic, we go and spend on it, we pay it off. And that's, you know, the credit industry in credit card industry is boom. This is just like a reform of a credit card, in my opinion. I think that's what's going on. I think a lot of people are, especially younger people, I'm not going to say millennials because I don't think millennials are really that young now, but sort of mid millennials and below, and you know, people in their 20s are kind of seeing this as an alternative to a credit card. You know, don't have to go through all of the credit checks to do it, which in one way could be a good thing, because if you get a credit card with a £2,000, £5,000 limit on it, and you fall into trouble with it, you know, the APR can be incredibly high. Yeah. If you're funding small purchases and then paying it off and playing the game correctly, there's no problem using this. But it's the people that are being encouraged to spend too much that they don't have, kicking the can down the road, getting into problems, finding that they might see that money go over to debt collectors, that kind of thing. And that's when it starts to become a problem. So,
what is regulation?
Absolutely. Definitely. It, 100% needs regulation. Yeah, when a part of a finance industry explodes like this and it becomes a more than £1 billion a year thing, definitely. And you think Klarna, I think, is the most valuable unicorn company in Europe. You know, it's exploded, you know, not just in Britain, but across the world very, very quickly. And, you know, the regulators probably should have acted a bit quicker, potentially, about this. And actually, it's a good thing now that people will be able to take any kind of gripes and problems to the ombudsman. Well, that serves two purposes. That one, it helps consumers who have been treated unfairly to take on companies, you know, without any risk. But also, it gives people such as journalists the chance to drill into data, to complaints data, and say, hold on a minute, there's been a massive surge of complaints in, you know, X, Y, and Z. What's going on here? And it gives us a chance to sort of read the figures. So look, I'm glad it's getting regulated. I'm on a bit of a neutral view here, where I think in some ways it can be okay. In other ways, yes, it is. It can be a real evil, because people are buying things that they don't need. And that's, you can't just crush innovation, Georgia, I don't think, because it's exploded out of nowhere, because it must be useful in some ways for some people. It's the percentage of people that fall into trouble and don't play the rules of the game properly. It's like having a credit card where you get air miles on it, for example. If you play the game right and you pay it off every month, and you know, you do your everyday spending on it, you pay it off on time, you never get any charges on it, and it's all great. If you do that, don't play by the rules of the game, and you're getting 50-60% APR, and you see the charge at the end of the day of that credit card isn't for you. And you shouldn't get involved. I think that the thing that's the most worrying about it, and this will be the last thing I say about this, is it's become almost like a default checkout option on a lot of retailer websites, and I don't think that's good. You know, people should be encouraged to save for something that they want to buy, but we know the world doesn't work like that. To push these kind of payment options onto people, and onto people that potentially already are in their overdraft or already in debt and cannot afford to do this, but they want that new dress or that new pair of trainers right now, it's not good. Yeah. And there probably needs to be more health warnings about that kind of thing.
I wonder if it's going to become almost a default option first in some places. It depends how much money they get through them. Now, I agree with you. Who are we as well to tell people what they need and what they don't need to buy? I think, but yeah, indeed, it's definitely known a proliferation at a time when people are concerned about money. People are spending time at home a lot more, and it's becoming very, very normalized. But finally, you have a question from a reader who has found their dream home in Surrey. It's on a managed estate. They made an offer. It was accepted, but have since found out that the house, which they would be buying freehold, is subject to something called estate rent charges. Now, they've read online that the original developer of the property could take possession without notice if they forgot to pay the charge, and also that there is no limit on how much money they can ask for. Now, I don't know where they saw this online. Simon, you can explain to me in a minute. I assume it was in just general Google searching as opposed to on sort of details of this property. But anyway, they're now worried that it will affect their ability to get a mortgage in the first place or to sell their home in the future. So they're asking you guys, big question here now, big decision, should they pull out of the sale and find somewhere else? Simon, firstly, what's a managed estate and what are estate rent charges?
Managed estate is somewhere where the roads and the area that the houses are built on is not public land. So in most cases, the roads, the greens, the area, the where you live will be owned by the local council. The council is, the local authority is responsible for maintaining things like the roads and the green areas and stuff like that. And after an estate of houses was built, that stuff would have been handed over to the local authority. I'm sitting here in my house now, looking out of my window on a small, two roads of houses that were all built in like the 1960s kind of thing. And all these houses were built by a developer, maybe a number of developers, onto new roads that were created, and then it was handed over to the council. So the council's responsible for the roads outside my house. Now, councils are quite keen to not take on extra responsibility for paying for stuff. Developers are quite keen to hand it over to people, but if they think there's a way that they can continue to make some money for years to come, are also open to the idea of continuing to charge people. Where you would be most likely to see this is in some form of gated estate, gated community, where you might have flats, but you also might equally likely have houses, you know, then they would be private roads. But you will also find it in places that you wouldn't necessarily think. You're not driving through a gate to get into them. It looks like you're just driving around normal roads of normal houses. But these estates are owned by the developer. Maybe the developer has then sold it on to someone else, or a management company runs it, and there will be an estate rent charge. And that goes towards ensuring the communal areas are maintained, and therefore it all remains very attractive and nice to people. The thing is, these charges can feel quite high to people, and they can feel that they aren't necessarily getting what they think they should get in return, or that the improvements aren't going on. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't buy somewhere based on it, but it does mean that you will need to recognize that you A, need to pay these charges, that you B, probably are not going to get protection from them in the way that many leaseholders will get protection from the stuff that's going on with leasehold at the moment, and C, if you don't pay them, you could find yourself in a spot of bother. Now, whether they're legally allowed to enter and possess your home is another matter, but it might say that, you know, in the agreement. And if it says that in the agreement, then you need to take it on the basis that they can actually do that, and you need to factor these charges into the cost of owning the property.
So the advice is?
Well, the advice is don't necessarily pull out of buying the property. They don't have to be a barrier to buying a home. Mm-hmm. They don't make the process any easier, but they don't necessarily have to make it much harder. It's not entirely uncommon. As long as they're reasonable, they're not, you know, massively extortionate, and there's no clauses that says that they go up by a certain percent and then that compounds and compounds and compounds, and that all of a sudden they might seem reasonable now, but in 10 years' time they're going to be very, very expensive. There's no reason not to do it, but it is something that might detract slightly from your desire to buy a property, just as in the same way that a very high service charge might detract from your desire to buy a property in a block of flats. But most property developers and estate managers are moving away from these things And so they're shifting instead to like asking buyers to enter into a covenant where they commit to paying maintenance charges up until the point where they sell, at which point the next buyer would enter into the maintenance charges, more structured kind of maintenance charges. But basically just bear in mind, if you're buying a place, that you need to check whether there are other costs that come with it that you are going to have to pay.
Indeed, good advice. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news just to go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any questions or any other comments for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, any investing mistakes that you've made that we can all learn from, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to read all the podcast articles past, find the archive and join in the debate and read comments. And yeah, please do send us in your stories of your investing mistakes. And if you do, we will feature them anonymously on the podcast next week, unless you say that you want us to name you.
If you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.